So we're going to talk first about, look at this, about who has genital herpes, a little bit about epidemiology. And this is not me, but anyway. So viral versus bacterial STDs, viral certainly prolonged lifelong infection, more widespread at the in the population, not curable at the present time, lower ratio of serious outcomes to overall incidence and prevalence. They present diagnostic challenges for sure, and we're going to talk about that today. Prevention is more dependent on behavioral measures and immunization, and there's a greater potential for vaccines, as we already have hepatitis B and HPV vaccines. So this is a, I should preface this by saying that if you work in the area of herpes, a lot of this will be review and just fine-tuning for you. If you don't, there'll hopefully be more new information for you. I think it never hurts to review, even if this is something that you work with, and hopefully you'll get a few new things. But my impression at previous meetings of this particular kind was that a lot of people work in areas other than herpes, that they specialize in chlamydia or gonorrhea or syphilis or HIV. And though a lot is known about herpes, it's always good to get a little brush up. So this is pretty basic stuff. HSV-1, certainly we're seeing, oh, there he is. Please, feel free to do this.
I really apologize. After all the on and off about the session timing and so on, I had in my brain 10:15 instead of 10:30, as opposed to 10 instead of 10:15, and I do apologize. I also have a slightly modified slide set, but I'll use these. How's that sound? So you already did this. Thank you, Terry, for doing that. And what I would, the addition that I made on the notion of greater promise for effective vaccines has a HSV-2 question mark in there, and has HIV with a triple question mark by it for someday. But other than that, that was the only change there. And I just thought, as the first presentation, with apology again for my screwed up schedule, that even though this is mostly epidemiology, that it would be good to just have an introduction of the basics of the virology and the clinical status. How did you get all the way through this, Terry, or had you just pretty much started it?
Two-thirds.
Okay, so the bottom line is HSV-1, mostly oral, a lot of initial genital, much lower frequency of recurrence, and for that matter, much less frequency of subclinical shedding in the genital area than for HSV-2, which has important implications clinically and in counseling and in prevention strategies. HSV-2, although either virus can infect either anatomic area, HSV-2 infections are more genital specific than HSV-1 is oral specific, so that it is rare to get, not unheard of, but HSV-2 orally is uncommon. When it is acquired, most of the cases are in people who acquire HSV-2 both genitally and orally at the same time, as opposed to somebody who shows up only with oral HSV-2, and it is the rare person with recurrent oral herpes who has HSV-2 infection. And the vast majority of recurrent genital herpes is due to HSV-2 and not HSV-1. So perhaps a critical take-home message for those interested in this is the discrepancy between several discrepancies. One of them is between how severe the disease actually is at a biological clinical level as compared with how fearful people are of it. And that leads to this sort of notion of this sort of sense of horror, shame, and so on that patients who either have newly diagnosed herpes or are afraid they're going to get it feel about the disease. The problem is that because of that very discrepancy, clinicians who don't think about this in a critical way tend to have a head in the sand attitude about it that sort of tends to look at those frequently mild and often trivial and totally asymptomatic clinical manifestations, and it's sort of, oh, don't worry your pretty little head about it, my dear, it's just herpes. And that is, and one of the tasks that providers have is to help patients understand the real story, that there is a middle ground, that nobody wants to have this disease, but the vast majority with it can learn to live with it and have rewarding lives, both sexually, romantically, and in every other way. So measuring epidemiology of herpes, the crudest approach is simply what is done by CDC every year by monitoring the number of initial visits to physicians' offices for a diagnosis or management of genital herpes with this upward trend, the up and downness from year to year, representing sampling artifact issues as opposed to disease transmission issues. The upward trend is clear. From these two kinds of data, you can't distinguish the difference between rising incidence, increasing physician capabilities in diagnosis, and increasing concern. That is, the more publicity there is, the more people go in with perhaps previously less severe conditions. So the upward trend is clear, but whether this is due to incidence or something else can't be determined from that. It probably is a pretty good measure of trends in concern by patients with the disease and or physician awareness of diagnosis. Now this slide looks at the prevalence of STDs in the US in a broad sense. Now the HPV bar here is a little misleading because it looks only at warts. And we all know that the proportion of persons with HPV infection who have subclinical infection far outnumbers those. So if we had all HPV infections displayed here at any point in time, it would probably be a lot higher than the herpes bar. But in terms of overt clinical wart disease, this is probably a pretty fair representation. It puts a context for herpes frequency compared with other common STDs. I was going to say something else about that, and I'm forgetting. HPV, for a long time, was thought, well, you got it. And people said, well, once you get it, you have it forever. And biologically, you may. But most people don't have detectable HPV forever. It goes away typically in a few months and mostly doesn't recur, although obviously that can occur. So clinically, for practical purposes, people are cured. HSV-2, however, I mean, the joke among some people who study disease, what's the difference between herpes and true love? Herpes is forever. And herpes is forever. Once you get it, you got it, and it ain't going to go away. So 1.6 million new cases a year, I think these data, so, you know, These numbers could be anywhere from 500,000 to 2 million. They're rough estimates. It's a lot. Almost all of you, I'm sure, are aware of the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data, national population-based data, which would suggest that from the late 70s until the late 90s, over a decade, the prevalence rose. Then the prevalence dropped. That dropped to 17% in the around 2000, early 2000s, 6-7 years ago, the midpoint, has been puzzling people a lot, whether it's real or not, and why a prevalent disease that doesn't go away should decline. Even as new infections decline, the prevalence is an issue. But I think the take-home message is around 1 in 5 people are infected. Now, Peter, these are showing data that Peter properly ought to be showing himself. To sort of validate this and sort of demonstrate to the average doc out there in the real practicing world, do these data really apply to me? A study was designed that specifically looked at people going in for routine health care, not STD-related, not herpes-related, to private physicians in mostly suburban as opposed to downtown or rural communities in the city, in the metropolitan areas that you see on the slide. So 6 clinics per community, 36 sites, 150 persons per clinic, and it was part of their normal visit. And the bottom line is that it was a pretty typical office practice group, 60% married, 80% employed, higher education, 74.5%, college degree and a third, pretty high household income, sort of like a suburban practice setting, mostly insured population, and with the racial distribution that you see here, 75% white, 14% black, smaller numbers of other groups. And the bottom line is that the prevalence was essentially the same ballpark as we saw in the national survey. 25% of people coming in were seropositive for HSV2, indicating that they clearly have HSV2 infection. There are some little minor issues around how the blood tests get interpreted. We'll hear more about that later. But even if you were to adjust this for a conservative interpretation of the blood test, you might drop to 20% prevalence tops, minimum. So very much like NHANES, and as in NHANES, a large majority say they don't have herpes. There is a strong association, both in NHANES and in this data set, with race and ethnicity, with African Americans having a substantially higher rate than the others. But it is not a rare phenomenon in any population group, and that's the take-home message. Education, again, has an influence. Lesser education, higher prevalences. This obviously interacts to some extent with the race-ethnicity paradigm, but no group is spared. And similarly, if you look at sexual prevalence, most STDs are more efficiently transmitted male to female than female to male. It has to do with the anatomy of sex and susceptibility of the areas involved. So that prevalent STDs like herpes generally show up more frequently in women than in men. Same is true for HPV infection. Although partly in HPV it's an issue of how you detect the virus, but you basically see this rising trend as you would expect for sexually transmitted infection during the years of greatest sexual activity, and then stabilization at higher rates in older populations. I guess we've now, have you merged this into a single data set and so on? So I had added in this thing that I thought I had 5 minutes to plug in, just some take-home messages. Very common, mostly subclinical or asymptomatic, and that frequency, that commonality is influenced by, but not in any rigid way, socioeconomic status, race or gender. Everybody really is at risk, is popular to say, for STDs. It's not so true with gonorrhea and HIV and syphilis. Not everybody is equal risk. Herpes is an equal opportunity STD. Thank you. I apologize again for screwing up the opening session. Thank you.
Thanks, Hunter. Well, I'm going to talk to you about several topics here. First, I want to talk about diagnosis. I think diagnosis is a stumbling block for a lot of clinicians. How do you do it best? What tools do you use? How do you interpret the results that you get? So some of these are my thoughts, and this is my thought. So in order of preference, a swab test, I think, is good if you can get a positive, because a swab test tells you not only what you have, but where you have it. So it's really clear. The major labs are all now offering polymerase chain reaction for herpes. Quest, LabCorp, two tests are, and they're not FDA approved at this point, but there are two tests coming to FDA approval, two PCR tests. And you always want to order typing. And we're going to talk about why typing is important, but it's essential. I hear now, even still, from the providers in my community, we know that your herpes test is positive, but we didn't look for typing because it's not important. And as Hunter said, that's really erroneous. It's very important, and we'll talk more about why. Then, type-specific antibody testing. The main issue that we have right now with type-specific antibody testing, the main issue, we have a few and we'll talk about them, is that for HSV1, it doesn't tell you where the infection is in a person who's never had a cold sore. And because we see so much new HSV1 genital infection, this is kind of an issue. And that's why the swab test is better, because it does tell you where it is. And then physical exam, I think, should fall way down the road. Certainly physical exam should be done if you have a patient with symptoms, particularly, excuse me, I have a cold. But clinicians have a 20% error rate in calling things herpes that are not. And this has actually been seen in two large studies. So it's important to know that if a patient has been diagnosed with herpes just by somebody looking at them, that they need more of a diagnosis than that. So the swab tests that look for herpes, these would be done in the symptomatic person. Probably not a great idea, unless you're doing a study where you're looking for asymptomatic shedding, to be swabbing people who don't report any sensations that are different or anything in their skin that looks different. You could, and certainly patients have said to me, there's this place on my labia that feels weird, and I don't see anything there, but I'll swab it, and it's been positive. So something to trigger the swab rather than just swabbing blindly. PCR is 2 to 4 times more sensitive than culture, depending on the study that you read. It's more stable. So you could collect a PCR and put it in your refrigerator and keep it for 2 months at home. So that's a nice thing to have. When we have patients who have symptoms, let's say they're HSV-1 positive, they've never had a cold sore. We know they're infected with HSV-1, but we don't know where. We will often send swabs home with people and say, when you get those symptoms, you gather the swab. You're able to do that. We know for all these daily home swabbing studies that people do a really nice job gathering their own swabs. So giving people swabs to take home to collect when they have symptoms empowers them to some degree, and it also allows them to gather a swab sooner than you could probably see them in your office. So I think that's a good idea. You might want to check how your media works, whether it's things that they can keep out of the refrigerator or need to be refrigerated. Culture, in a study by University of Washington, had a 76% false negative rate compared to PCR. So it misses quite a bit of infection, particularly if the lesion is older when the patient presents to you. It's vulnerable to transport and time issues, so you have to be careful about what you do with it after you gather it. If you're using culture, you need to put it in the refrigerator after you get it. You'll notice that a lot of what I have to say to you is practical. Is practical okay? Because I think it's useful. And you have to get it to the lab. If you gather a culture on a Friday afternoon, you need to get it to the lab that afternoon. If you wait until Monday, there's a good chance that you'll lose the virus that's there. We were doing a study with the University of Washington, sending samples up to them via FedEx. And if we sent it on a Friday, we almost never got anything at all on a Monday. And the longer it took to get there, the less positivity there was. The media that you use is the same. You'll probably use that viral transport media that tends to be pink. And you can use that for culture or for PCR. The difference is what you ask for on the lab slip, not the media that you use and not the swab that you use. That's all the same. But on your lab slip, you need to ask for PCR with typing as opposed to culture with typing. When you do this, you want to use the polyester or Dacron tip swabs plastic shaft. Never wood, never cotton. They're not good for either of those systems. So if you drop your swab that comes with the kit, don't grab a cotton swab out of your drawer. Be sure that you use the right kind of swab. That's important too. Why do you request typing of the virus? Let's go back to this for just a minute. I think it's also important to know that you need to be aggressive with your swabbing. I tell people, this is going to probably hurt. I want you to count to 10 and I'll be done. But the longer you let me do this and the more you let me rub, the better answer we're going to get. So just hang in there with me. Sometimes people can't handle it, but we do the best we can. You don't have to do, on a woman with lots of external lesions, you don't necessarily have to do a look at their cervix that time. You don't have to put a speculum in their vagina if they're really uncomfortable. So why request typing of the virus? Well, HSV-1 is very likely, not always certainly, but very likely to be oral to genital transmission, mouth to genitals. And we know that in college students and high school students, by a really nice study by Craig Roberts, that about 3/4 of new infection is type 1, not type 2. Lots of oral genital contact in that age group. But it can also happen in a completely monogamous married couple. I have this all the time. I do all the herpes questions on WebMD. And Hunter and I both do boards on this place called MedHelp, where people post questions and then we answer the questions. And people in long-term relationships can acquire genital herpes from one giving oral sex to the other. I had a couple on WebMD. The guy wrote to me. He was 64 years old, married for ages, I think 40 years or something. And his wife came down with a genital lesion. She went in to see her OB, who swabbed it and it was positive for herpes. And he told her that her husband had to have another partner for her to get this. They were both virgins to their marriage. And he wrote to me and said, I've never had another partner. And this just isn't true. And I said, well, was it typed? And he said, he checked and he wrote me back and said, no, her doctor told her if it's genital, it's type 2. If it's below the waist, it's type 2. So I said, do you give her oral sex? And he said, almost every time we have sex. And I thought, lucky lady. No, I didn't say that, but I thought that. But anyway, so I said, well, why don't you wait a little while and see if you can get an antibody test. And I'm guessing she's going to be positive for type 1 and not for type 2. And he wouldn't do it. And he told her, that's a bad recommendation. This is HSV2. And your husband had another partner, and she divorced him. Because her doctor, she was sort of in that age group where, you know, your doctor doesn't make mistakes like this. And it was the saddest thing, and I couldn't intervene through my contract with WebMD. I can't have individual interactions. And it was just a really sad situation. So typing is really important. Don't forget. It means something to people. The prognosis is different. So type 1 will recur maybe every other year, not very often, and a lot of people with type 1 never recur. Type 2, on the other hand, 3 to 6 times per year on average. 20% of people with type 2 have more than 10 outbreaks a year. So there's a wide range even for type 2. We think that having type 2 largely protects you against getting type 1, but having type 1 doesn't really protect you against getting type 2. Studies have been a little bit mixed about this, about whether it offers protection, but if it does, it certainly isn't complete. What we do know is that if you have type 1 first and you acquire type 2, that your type 2 is likely to be mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic. So the type 1 antibody sees the type 2 coming and says, oh, I know who you are, and keeps things really under control, but doesn't stop it from visiting. So I think these things are important in terms of how you talk to people about what kinds of sexual contact you can have. Your treatment choice may be different. So for us, we initiate suppressive therapy quickly in people's infection. And we normally do both swab tests and antibody tests with people who present with their first symptoms. People want to know often, is this the first time I got herpes or have I had it before? And the combination of antibody testing and swab testing can help you with that. So if they have new type 2, we will often put them on suppression for 6 to 12 months. We'll do the first episode thing and then the suppression. My feeling about this is that we've had the use of suppression backwards, that people have the most outbreaks in the first year, the most shedding in the first year, the most psychological distress in the first year, and yet we waited until they had X number of outbreaks before we helped them. And I think that's a mistake. Having said that, if you treat people early on and you don't have a positive diagnosis, the University of Washington Western Blot people are now putting on their report, if you have been on suppressive therapy from the beginning, this may not be accurate. So the deal there is, if you put a person on suppression early, you have no positive swab test, no positive antibody test, it just looks like herpes to you. You still want to confirm that by bringing them back in about 3 or 4 months for the antibody test. But if they've been on suppression and their antibody test is still negative, then the antiviral therapy may have interfered with their ability to make antibody. So you want to pull them off suppression and let them see if they make antibody. So just think about the use of suppression if you don't have a clear diagnosis, because this is the statement now that they have on their Western blot forms. So let's talk about the antibody tests. There's a category that's a type-specific ELISA IgG, and there's a lot of companies now that are making it. And it really confuses the issue, because there's a test out now by Zeus where the index values are nowhere near in the same range as the ones we're used to. So how many of you do antibody testing in your practice? Okay. Well, if you do it, you know that it comes back with a number. It's called an index value. And anything over 1.1 is considered positive. Anything under 0.9 is negative. But these Zeus values are in the hundreds. So when I started getting people on WebMD posting their values for me to look at, it was like 286. And I said, okay, so go back and look at the test result again and see if you're missing a decimal point. Well, they weren't. So I got one person to tell me what lab they'd had it done in, and I called the lab and I asked, what's going on here? And they told me that they were using this new Zeus test. So if you have people bringing in lab tests, it may be difficult for you to interpret them. Hi, Charlie. Mr. Herpes, hey. Charlie Evil, formerly of Asha. Good to see you. So it may be hard for you to sort out, is my point, because it's hard now for me to sort out. So there's several different companies that make this kind of a test. Then the immunoblot is made by Herpes Select, and it gives you just a positive negative. It's on a strip. It looks at both. The BioKit is an in-office test for herpes. It looks only for type 2. Takes about 15 minutes, but you do need a moderate complexity lab, CLIA certified moderate complexity to do it, which is kind of the drawback, because we're thinking this would be great. In-office test, easy to do, pretty reliable, but it's still moderate complexity certification. Herpes Select had an in-office test for type 2 on the market for a while. They pulled that and they are not bringing it back. So the test thing is changing all the time. But I think if we just kind of focus on the ones that are most commonly used, which is Herpes Select by Quest, and Quest does almost half the lab work for the country, and LabCorp, which is another big one. LabCorp uses a company called CAPTIA, but it's the same index values, the same numbers. We can think about that pretty clearly. And then finally, the Western blot. Only the University of Washington in the United States does the Western blot. But you can send it from anywhere to them, and they have a whole system for doing that. And it can be sent through the national labs, and I'm going to tell you how to do that too. This gives you a report that's either positive, negative, or indeterminate for HSV1 and 2. They automatically do both. It's not a good screening test because it looks for all the proteins associated with the antibody, and it takes a while for all those proteins to be present. So it's not a great screening test, but it is a good test for sort of sorting out conflicting results, or if people come in and say, I read about this on the internet, you can send them to the University of Washington. By the way, we should talk about questions. If you just jot down questions, that would be great. We want to have lots of time for questions, but I think we're going to hold them for a little while, because we could end up not having enough time to do this. So the sensitivity and specificity for type 1 is lower than for type, the sensitivity is quite a bit lower. So it picks up about 9 out of 10 type 1 infections, and about 96, 97% for type 2. So those of you that got that wrong, was that on your test? Yes. It's more sensitive for type 2 than it is for type 1. And you'll encounter that if you use this quite a bit. You'll have patients who come in and say, I've had cold sores my whole life, that are negative for type 1 on their antibody test. When you do this test, when we do it anyway, we always ask people, have you ever in your life had a cold sore on your lip? I think it's important to get that history so that when you give results, you can say, consistent with what you told me about cold sores, your HSV1 is positive. Or, since you have never had a cold sore, we can't tell you if your type 1 infection is oral or genital. But if you get a symptom in either location, come and see us. When you ask about cold sores, it's also good to distinguish between that and canker sores, because canker sores are not caused by herpes, but people in their head mix them up all the time. So when they say, yes, I've had cold sores since I was a kid, ask, are they on the inside of your mouth or on the outside? Are they in your nose or on your lip or on your chin? No, they're in my mouth and I get them from eating grapefruit. That's not herpes. So try and help people sort out a little bit canker sores from cold sores. Let's talk about timing for your tests. Remember that you're looking for something that people make on their own, not something that they get from someone else when you're looking for antibody. Just like with HIV, somebody comes to you and says, I had sex with a commercial sex worker, though they wouldn't say that, but they did that 3 nights ago, and I want to get tested for everything. You can't, because you're waiting for antibody to develop. And the same is true for herpes. So the numbers are approximately this. By 3 weeks from infection, not symptoms, infection, about half the people will have made antibody. By 6 weeks, about 70%, and by 4 months, most everyone that's going to seroconvert will do it. Some people take longer, not very often, but think about the antiviral therapy in that context as well. People that have HSV-1 already will take a little bit longer to become positive for HSV-2 if they are infected. So keep that in your thoughts as well. We recommend that you don't use IgM blood tests. And since I've been doing this WebMD thing, where people post just tons of stuff, and in my practice in my clinic that I've been doing for almost 30 years now, I have a lot of people bringing in IgM positive tests. They've been told they have herpes based on an IgM test. Not only that you have herpes, but that you have new herpes. And I think it's important to remember that every time you do a diagnosis of herpes, it's never just a medical issue. It's a psychosocial issue, a relationship issue, an emotional one. So you need to keep that in mind when you're doing this, and you don't want to screw up. So a lot of people that I'm seeing as patients or reading on WebMD tell me that they're positive for IgM, but negative for IgG. Now, it's possible that when you get new herpes, you could have IgM as a new infection and you will seroconvert to IgG. But I have seen tons of people who are positive on IgMs that never become positive on IgG. So it's not type specific. It can't really sort out type 1 from type 2, and most tests disclose that. But we think it also cross-reacts with other viruses. Not sure exactly what they all are, or why people have false positive IgMs, but if you look at the false positive IgMs, they're usually low numbers as well. We know that it's present in about 35% of recurrences, so it really doesn't help us sort out new from old infection either. So be really careful. I would say never order an IgM. We're trying to figure out how to get money so that we can do a study to look at the accuracy of positive IgMs in people who follow up negative by IgG. I haven't quite arranged that yet. But you want to be careful, I would say, not to order it. And if you do somehow have to order it, which I don't think you do, that you don't interpret it incorrectly. So here are some codes, again, sort of practical stuff. If you use national labs, that you would want to use to order these tests. And Quest, I have here for type 1 and type 2, both separately and together. When I say separately, it gives you type 1 and type 2, not bunched together. Let's talk for a minute about what we call low positive values. And I think this is what Hunter was talking about in his interpretation of Peter's study data. Again, the index value. We have seen false positives in the low positive range. And we reflexively confirm all positives in the range of 1.1 to 3.5 in the person who doesn't have any symptoms. Now, if somebody has, you know, genital sores every 2 months, and or someone with a positive swab test, we wouldn't need to do that. But in somebody who says, I've never had any symptoms, I've got this value, we would confirm those with Western blot. Jeff Gilbert up in New York confirms with BioKit. And I think that's a reasonable thing, too. It seems unlikely that if it's, and I think there's an article, I know there's an article in the literature looking at BioKit as a confirmatory test for low positives, and it really, really helps. So do something in the person who is 1.1 to 3.5. I went back and looked at the literature in our clinic. We have a highly complex CLIA-certified lab within our clinic, and we run these tests every week. We run about 100 and some a month. And we looked back to see if we could predict false positives. Now, at the University of Washington, Matt Golden looked at this and found there was a high correlation of false positives for HSV-2 with people that were 1 positive. We found some of that, but we also found people that were false positive for type 2 who had no type 1. So I don't know that you could strictly rely on that. But we've had false positives up to 2.74. So I think this is worth doing. This is a lifelong, highly stigmatized sexually transmitted infection, and we need to handle this with as much care as we can. If you use one of the national labs, you can set this up reflexively. So with Quest, the confirmation code for Western blot is 34534. And again, you can, you know, have your lab slips printed and all that. In some states, there are 6 states in the United States where they cannot send labs out of state. And since the University of Washington is the only place where this is done, that presents some problems. Again, Jeff Gilbert in New York has figured out a way to do that. They have this big process and it takes a lot of time, but they are able to do it. Some states are not able to do it. So again, with this WebMD thing and the MedHelp thing that we have going on where people post to boards, they'll find us sometimes, even though they're not supposed to. And we end up ordering for people all around the country. So 6 states won't let you do it, so you just need to be aware of that. For LabCorp, these are the codes, and you have to write in the Western blot, but they will do it. I think it's a little bit more iffy about whether it'll actually happen. Who are candidates for the blood tests? And I think, these are, again, me. Anybody requesting an STD screen? If you're doing STD screens and you're not including HSV2, which is the most prevalent STI around, even because warts come and go, as Hunter said. So think of the difference between prevalence and incidence. More new cases, incidence, established cases, prevalence. Someone whose current or previous partner has herpes, and they want to know if they have it themselves. A negative swab test, but you still feel like, gosh, those symptoms look like herpes to me. Go ahead and wait the appropriate amount of time from their last sexual contact, and then do the antibody test. Someone who wants to know if this is their first infection or not. So if they have a positive swab test, let's say it's positive for type 2, and a negative antibody test for type 2, what does that tell you? It's new, because they have virus present on their skin, but not enough time has gone by to make an antibody response. So positive swab, negative serology equals new infection. And that's useful for some people to know. Someone who's been diagnosed by exam only and wants confirmation of that diagnosis or typing of their virus. Someone who has recurrent genital symptoms that you can't sort out by some other lab test. Or someone who has this sort of dysuria pyuria syndrome. So it hurts when they pee, and they come into your office and you dip their urine, and it's positive for leukocytes, maybe not knock your socks off leukocytes, but positive for leukocytes. And when you send their urine to the lab, nothing grows. And they come in more than once for that. So, and nothing ever grows. I would think herpetic urethritis is a possibility, and certainly do an antibody test. Now, if they're HSV2 positive, the CDC and their treatment guidelines says the person who is positive but asymptomatic should be managed in exactly the same way as the person who is positive and with symptoms. So it doesn't tell you that necessarily their dysuria pyuria is due to herpes in the urethra, but it would, in my mind, be worth a trial of suppression to see if you could make those symptoms either go away or come less often. And then HIV-positive patients need to know their herpes status as well. Here's some codes for getting insurance to reimburse you for testing. So in our practice, we have a private practice, and it's important that we code correctly so people get paid for testing. So these are some codes that you can use when you bill. So genital itching, pain with intercourse, pain with urination, female genital pain, pain down the back of the leg. And then this is a great code. I like this 782.0 because this covers just a wide variety of things. Burning, tingling, numbness, prickling, hypoesthesia, and hyperesthesia. So a multitude of sins get covered by one code, and we use this one quite a bit. By the way, if you want copies of the slides, we're going to have them posted on the CDC website so you don't have to write everything down. You're welcome. Okay, we're not going to talk about this because Greg's telling me we're short on time. Is that okay if we don't talk about this?
We have about 25 minutes.
Okay. So, well, we could. I think we shouldn't because we want to have a good discussion too. So, is this genital herpes? It is. Is this genital herpes? Can you see where this is? This is on somebody's butt. Is this genital herpes? Yes, it is. Yeah, I'm serious. Is this at the anus genital herpes? Yes. Is this at the urethra genital herpes? Yes, this is genital herpes also. And how about here on the thigh? Is this genital herpes?
Yes.
Yes. So all of these are genital herpes. When you're thinking about genital herpes, think waist to mid-thigh. The virus goes in through a sexual encounter that uses the genitals, but once it's in place, it lives in the sacral ganglia, and it can come out on any branch of that nerve group. And that's kind of the boxer shorts area. So when you talk to patients about looking for recurrences, or you look yourself, think of the whole boxer shorts area. And if people say to you, well, I know this thing I get on my butt is herpes, and what I do is I cover it with a Band-Aid and have sex. Not good. Because Anna Wall did a study looking at those lesions and genital shedding, and people definitely shed in the genital area as well, even if their outbreaks are just on their bottom. And I've heard OBs say to me, oh yeah, I had a lesion up the thigh, and I just covered it with Opsite and did a vaginal delivery. My friend Zane Brown would just die if he heard that, who's an OBGYN in Seattle. So probably not a great idea. Let's talk a little bit about sexual transmission. We know something about transmission rates by a variety of studies that we've looked at. Either they were vaccine trials or they were treatment trials, where we had what we call discordant couples, where one's infected and the other is not. And the terms of the trials were that they were told to abstain from sex when there were outbreaks present. The reality was that they didn't use condoms very well. They were not taking antiviral therapy, so they were either in the placebo group or it wasn't a treatment study. And the partner is aware that herpes is in the relationship, the uninfected partner. And that turns out to be really important, because if you look at how long it takes for herpes to be transmitted in a couple, if the couple both know that it's there, it takes far longer to transmit than if the person doesn't know it's there. Which makes sense. It's a really neat study, very elegant, simple study by Anna Wald again, that's in the literature, and you could look at that. I think it's called Patient's Perception. I forget, something about patient perceptions of HSV. But it's a cool study, and she just asked newly infected people, did you or did you not know that your partner had herpes when you had sex with them? And if it was yes, it was a long time to acquisition. If it was no, it was a shorter time by far. So when you look at these rates, there's a wide range of rates. I mean, it's all over the place. But if you try to sort of put it together statistically by the number of patients and the frequency of transmission, it's about 10% in a year from male to female. And usually the numbers were that they had sex about twice a week. So what this means is that if there are 100 couples where the male has herpes and the female does not, and they're just having sex with each other twice a week, that about 10 of those women will get herpes in a year if there are none of the above things happening or all of the above things happening. If it's the female that's infected and her male partner is not, then it's about 4%. Let's talk for just a minute about the transmission study. This is a landmark kind of study where we looked at the ability of antiviral therapy to reduce the risk of transmission. It was international, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, heterosexual adults over 18 who were in a monogamous relationship. This person who had herpes was called the source partner, and they had 9 or fewer outbreaks per year. The source partners got either valacyclovir 500 milligrams once a day or placebo, and we followed them for 8 months. They were counseled at every visit on safer sex behavior. We offered them condoms. They had to document all their sexual encounters, be they oral, anal, or vaginal. And this was a really interesting thing, because some people love to tell us all about it. You know, they'd fill up a sheet, which had, I think, 30 places, and then they come and hand you the sheet at the front desk and say, I need a new sheet, with a look of glee. And other people really, you know, they'd have 3 sexual encounters in a month, and they'd have to tell us about, well, my mother-in-law was in town, and the baby was crying, and it was all this interesting overlay with the clinicians and the sexual behavior of these people. But monthly, we drew the susceptible partners to see about acquisition of infection. And what we found, we've got a lot of great stuff, what we found was that antiviral therapy daily cut transmission rates about in half. Now, we were a little disappointed, I would say, with this result. We expected better, because if you look at studies where people, they have herpes and they take antiviral therapy and they're doing swabbing of their own genitals, looking for the difference between no treatment and treatment, we found 75 to 80% reduction. So we're not exactly sure why we found this, but there were more women in the trial, which kind of bumps it in the direction of less efficacy. I think there were a number of things. I think the other thing is if you have a person taking medicine to protect someone else, that's a different situation than if you're taking it directly yourself. We saw that compliance went down a little when people weren't getting along or various things were happening. So there's a lot of factors there that we can't account for exactly. But this is a good thing. So we know now that, and I thought I corrected this, we know that condoms reduce transmission by about a third. We thought by about a half, but a meta-analysis recently showed us that condoms reduce transmission by about a third, and antiviral therapy by almost half. So when I talk to patients about transmission, I say, okay, this is similar to driving and not getting killed in a car accident. You take driver's ed when you're a kid, you don't drink and drive, you try to get enough sleep, you wear your seatbelt. So it's not just one thing that you do so you don't get killed in a car accident. But you can't, it's not perfect, all the things that you do. And with herpes, it's really similar. So we'd like you to take therapy if you have an uninfected partner. Use condoms if that's important to both of you. Be aware of symptoms. We talk about how subtle they can be. But in the end, those aren't perfect either. And in the end, the uninfected person has to take some risk. The infected person cannot be fully responsible for eliminating transmission. And I think this gets very difficult between couples sometimes. And it's very difficult if there's a person who's uninfected in a relationship with someone who is infected, and they cannot bring themselves to take the risk of having sex with that partner. Sometimes they stay in the relationship, but they won't touch them. And I think then the infected person develops this feeling about themselves that isn't good at all. And I think it's important for us as clinicians to say, you know, look out for that. Don't stay in this forever. If they can't do this, or they have sex with you and they run to the bathroom and wash their genitals, and it may not be good for you in the long run psychologically about your sexual self. Let's talk about asymptomatic viral shedding. This is the giving off of virus in the absence of symptoms. And we know about it by studies where we have people swabbing their genitals every day for some extended period of time. And you might say to yourself, well, what kind of weirdo would swab their genitals every day for 6 months? And I think that the weirdos are people that want to know something that symptoms cannot tell them about. And that is, how often is my body giving off virus? They might also do it for money. I mean, just be real. But it's not so bad, though, daily homestead. We know that it's most common in the first year. One of our studies that Anna and I did together, looking at three things, valacyclovir versus acyclovir versus placebo, found 42 days out of the first about 6 months of infection, people were shedding virus. And again, there's a range here. So on average, people shed with type 2 shed 8 to 25% of days, some people more, particularly if they're HIV infected. With oral type 1, the numbers range from 9 to 18% of days. This has not been very well studied, but certainly people with cold sores shed virus when they don't have symptoms. On average, people with genital type 1, 3 to 5% of days, maybe more, because this was a study using culture, not PCR. And then Anna did a study looking at oral HSV2 and found 1% of days. And this is a big question that people have. What if I get this orally? What if my partner has HSV2 and I give them oral sex and I get it in my mouth? Am I going to get, you know, frequent outbreaks? And as Hunter said, it's not common for people with oral HSV2 to recur. We've seen some oral HSV2 in our clinic, but it's almost always with first episode infection. As he said, people give oral sex too and have intercourse with the same person. But the oral part doesn't seem to be an issue after first episode. The sites of shedding that are most common are penis, labia, and anus. And it's responsible for about 70% of new transmissions, asymptomatic shedding. And I think this is the hardest piece of news for people to really deal with, is that there isn't a day that you can say to your partner, today I know I won't infect you. And that's not easy for people. We can reduce shedding in the individual by about 80% with daily antiviral therapy, which doesn't exactly jive with what we got out of the transmission trial. I want you to just look at this. Are there pointers, Greg, do you think?
The mouse does it on the screen.
Yeah. No, you have to put it down.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so in this particular study, a woman did swabbing of her genitals for 160 days. The first bar, the first top part is the first 80 days, and the bottom, the second 80 days. In this particular study, she collected separate swabs from the cervix and from the vulva. Let's just look at the vertical bars for now. Every place that there's a vertical bar, be it blue or yellow, is a day when this woman was giving off virus from her body. These are PCR results. In this particular study, semi-quantitative PCR was used. That is, it told her not only whether you were giving off virus or not, but approximately how much. So the taller the bar, the more virus is given off. For example, on day, I'm at a weird angle, 20 or something, that's a million copies, right there, million copies. On day 4, 10 copies, genomes. So you can see that this is the start of her first outbreak, right here. So everything prior to this is asymptomatic viral shedding where there's a vertical bar. And here's her next outbreak. So everything between here and here, all this stuff is asymptomatic viral shedding. And everything between here and here, this is a million copies shed, no symptoms. Here's a million copies shed with symptoms. Here's a million copies shed, no symptoms. The idea that asymptomatic shedding happens in lower quantities really isn't necessarily true. Both symptomatic and asymptomatic days can be with low or high copies. Here's an outbreak, one day shedding 10 copies. So what you see is not what you get. At this point right here, this woman began daily therapy. This is all placebo, and at this point she crosses over into treatment. In this case, it was acyclovir 400 BID. And you can see the difference in the shedding rates. It doesn't go away completely, but it's much reduced. So these medicines work to reduce viral shedding. We know that viral shedding can occur regardless of outbreak frequency. On the left, 0 to 3 outbreaks per year. On the right, 4 to 9 outbreaks per year, same shedding. It's not whether you're having symptoms or not, it's whether you're infected or not that matters. This is a study that Anna and I did looking at shedding in people, this is by culture, in people who've never had symptoms and people who have had symptoms. And it was just about the same between the two groups. People are at risk for shedding regardless how long they've been diagnosed. You can see there's very little difference here. And this came out of that transmission trial. We just finished a trial looking at people that have been infected for 10 years or more and found a mean of 13% of days shedding. However, we did notice that in this group of long-time infected people, there were more people who shed 0 days than there were in the earlier infected ones. Let's briefly talk about pregnancy and herpes. Some key concepts. Neonatal herpes most commonly results from newly acquired maternal infection, infection that happens in the last trimester. Seronegative women with infected partners are at the greatest risk of getting infected, so women who have neither type 1 nor type 2. Suppression is recommended from 34 to 36 weeks, and the dosing has changed some, so if you do OB, once-a-day dosing isn't recommended anymore. If it's acyclovir, it's 400 TID. If it's valacyclovir, 500 BID. C-section still when lesions are present, and consider type-specific serology for couples. Now, this is not an ACOG recommendation. It's not a recommendation from any agency that I know about, but I certainly think that in some cases, those are minimum standards, not prohibiting you from going farther and identifying discordant couples. If I were doing OB, I certainly would. That's, Zane Brown has influenced my life greatly about that. But I think if you ask women, would you rather know that you have herpes and people could do something about reducing the risk of your baby getting infected or upsetting you in your pregnancy, they would say, I'd rather know. How many of you women would rather know that you could have potential for, to infect your baby? And how many would you rather like to be in the dark? I just think mothers are like that. That's kind of what I think. And we could talk about the algorithm management of that if you were curious. In pregnancy, about 19% of women who are double negative whose partners have type 2 will acquire disease over that 9 months. Remember that in our other number, it was 10% in 12 months. These women are immunocompromised, and so they will be infected more easily. So really important in my mind to know partner status and your own status. Treatment. You can find this at a lot of different places, but I did want to point out, and I'll use my newfound skills, that we have an article published now that looks at using a shorter course of valacyclovir, 2 grams, and then 12 hours later, 2 grams again. This is what we're using for our patients when we use valacyclovir, and you know that's generic now, went generic December 1st. So that's an option for people. I think just all the short-time therapies are really what's appropriate if you're only doing episodic therapy. You may be aware mostly that acyclovir is hard to get right now. Have you had trouble in your areas? It's really hard, but it's supposed to get better. And I find it quite ironic that Valtrex goes off patent in December, and now we can't get acyclovir. But we can still get branded Valtrex, and there's some generic Valtrex around. It's just kind of an odd phenomena, I think. And I'm not talking about conspiracy theories, but it is odd, I think. But it's supposed to let up. And you can do generic acyclovir for around $15 to $16 a month. So that's fine for people. Long-term suppression. People often ask me about how long can I keep people on these medicines. I don't know exactly how long, but Steve Tiering published an article in JID looking at long-term use of acyclovir and found it to be very safe. You don't need to do safety labs. Or put people on drug holidays unless you want to. I think the thinking about that now is you certainly could, people could come off and see how they're doing, but it's not really consistent with what we know about the virus now, which is it's not about symptoms. And we'll talk about who might be good candidates for suppression and who not, but when you put people on drug holidays that have an uninfected partner, I think you're offering an opportunity for transmission. Who would benefit from suppression? Someone with an uninfected sexual partner. If you can't do that much for your partner if you have herpes to go on daily medicine, I think there's something not quite okay there. So I think this is a simple thing to do. We know that these medicines are very safe. I've heard Hunter say they're safer than aspirin. And I think that's a simple thing you can do. Someone who has multiple sexual partners that isn't perhaps testing or telling everyone about the herpes would benefit. Someone with new herpes, because we know that people shed so much in the beginning. Women late in pregnancy, people concerned about HIV acquisition risk, certainly people with HIV now, we're seeing in studies that those folks are living longer if they're on the nucleoside analogs, and people who are bothered by their outbreaks. There isn't some magic number. Forget about the magic number. There is no magic number. And who might not benefit? Well, people who have herpes but aren't sexually active and aren't bothered by outbreaks. I don't see a benefit for them. People whose partner is infected with their same type. So if they both have type 2, we don't worry about them. If they both have type 1, we don't worry about them. People who aren't bothered by their outbreaks, and couples who've made the conscious decision, they're not going to worry about it. The sex police will not come to your door and ask if you're on suppression, if you're discordant. So it's what people decide to do. And I think that people kind of move along a continuum. You know, when they're first together and they don't know where the relationship is going, they might do everything that they can to prevent transmission, condoms and therapy and lots of caution. But as they move into a longer-term relationship, they may decide to bag the condoms and just do therapy. And then at some point they may say, well, you know, whatever. I think if you have people on suppression to try to reduce the risk of transmission, that you should periodically test the uninfected person, if that's the only reason they're on suppression, and see if they got infected. I'd say every couple of years, to see if that transmission has occurred and they don't know it. Remember that about 90% of people, as in Hunter's slide, who have herpes, do not know that they are infected. So there's an interesting article that I just read right before I came here. They did this study in Canada and they asked all the OBs, what are you doing about herpes in pregnancy? And 92% said they were asking their patients if they had herpes. And if they did, then they did these interventions. And if they didn't, they asked if their partner had herpes. And then if their partner had herpes, they suggested to a very small degree that their partner should be on suppression. To me, asking people if they have herpes misses so many people. that it just seemed really interesting. At the end, the summary was, isn't it nice that they're all complying with the guidelines? And I thought, wow, that's kind of an interesting guideline. But that's kind of where we are right now with that. Let's finish up my part with counseling. How am I doing, Mr. Gregg? Oh, aren't I doing well? Okay. So I think that you as clinicians, if you diagnose somebody with genital herpes, can make a huge impact on the future of these people's adjustment. I know, I have a master's degree in counseling also, and I know that I use that all the time when I talk to people. And the first thing I tell them when I tell them I believe they have herpes, and I will tell them it looks like herpes to me even before their labs come back, because I want them to be thinking along those lines, and I treat them before their labs come back, I say, you are the same person that you were before you walked into this office with these symptoms. Don't somehow decide that you're different now, because you are the core of who you are. And I don't want you going down that path where you've decided that somehow you're less worthy than somebody else, or you're skanky, or you're bad, or you're slutty. Don't go there. That's not true. This is one aspect of who you are. And I think that message needs to come early and be repeated, that this is just one part of who you are. You can still have children. God knows 90% of the women that have herpes don't know they have it and they're delivering. I mean, it's certainly happening. And men can impregnate women, and they often ask, well, what if I, you know, am I going to have to infect my wife if I get her pregnant if she doesn't have it and I do? And it's interesting because I wrote a book chapter, and it's being reviewed by these British folks, and I said in the book chapter, you could use a turkey baster if you were really worried about it to impregnate your wife. And they wrote back and said, What is a turkey baster, and what's that about? So I had to kind of spell it out. It was weird. You can still have sex. It's a really good idea to tell people so that they have a choice about exposure. But you can still have sex. That telling part is a challenge. And I have a book up here that I wrote, and I devote a whole chapter to telling, because I think it's not easy. You put yourself on the line, and you risk getting rejected, and if it happens, it can be really hard to bounce back. You can transmit virus between outbreaks. Hard piece of news to hear, but really important. There are effective treatments. You need to give yourself time. You're not going to feel great tomorrow or in a month, but in 6 months, you're going to feel a lot better, and in a year, you're going to feel a lot better, too. You can come back. People don't often come back. We have about 15% return rate just to talk about herpes. But some people do, and just knowing that they can come back. I underwent marriage counseling this year, and we got dismissed, and we're all done. But I remember our therapist said to us, you can always come back and see me if you hit a rough spot. And I thought, oh, thank God. And we haven't seen her again, but I knew that she was there if I wanted to go back, and I think you can tell people that. And I tell people you can have one problem, which is herpes, or you can have two problems, and your two problems might be you have herpes and you're angry, or you have herpes and you're depressed, or you have herpes and you reject your partner because you think they gave you herpes and there was some subterfuge to that. So you can, or as we were saying, you can have herpes and HBV or HIV. I mean, you can have, you kind of shape with the emotional stuff what you have. Do you have one problem, genital herpes, or do you have two? Are you isolated and depressed and scared and mad? Or do you just have herpes and try to not have two problems? Some things you don't want to say. When you have more than one partner, these things happen. These are things that my patients have actually told me their provider said to them. Your partner must have had sex with someone else for you to get this. Sometimes that's true, but it isn't necessarily true. You can have herpes for years and never know it. It's not so bad, it could be AIDS. Well, that's true too, but that's not much of a consolation. It sort of gives the message that you could, you know, you don't, it's not important. And it's just a cold sore down there. Even if it's type 1, you know, that's sort of true, but I don't think it's very comforting. And just avoid sex with outbreaks and you'll be fine. Not the truth.